Well, I'm starting a new sermon series, starting last Sunday morning. You all missed the beginning of it, but it was really good, so we're going to do it again. You really just don't realize how much you miss assembling with the brethren until you can't. And then it seems, I know that you have felt the same way, it just seems like the whole week is completely out of joint. There's nothing works right for the rest of the week after you've blown Sunday somehow. So anyway, we're delighted to be here. It's Sunday night, we always do this. Let's do the quick poll. How are you on your daily Bible reading so far? Everybody who's current or reasonably so, that's great. Stick with it. This sermon doesn't have anything to do with daily Bible reading, but that's okay. We'll get to it in time. Several things have come to my attention lately to point out that we need to be reminded of some very fundamental kinds of issues, and so I've started this sermon series about milk. We talk about the milk of the Word, and we think, well, we only got to get past that and get on to the meat of the Word, but there's something to be said for the milk of the Word, and we need to be reminded from time to time of the things that go on. I want you to think, we can do this, honest. Don't anybody panic. This is going to work, I promise you. Honest, it's going to work. Don't panic. See? I didn't do anything. Larry, you clicked that, didn't you? Okay. Now, don't click it this time. Let's see if any... No, this is not going to work. Reach up and push the red button on the back of the receiver, will you please? This happens from time to time. Doesn't mean a thing. Except technology doesn't always work the way you want. Okay, this past spring, honest, we can do this. This past spring, hey, did you do that one? All right! this past fall, a student at Holly Township High School went to the Detroit Institute of Arts. That's a picture of the interior of the Detroit Institute of Arts. Beautiful art museum. And there he saw this painting. It is $1.5 million painting by a woman named Helen Frankenthaler. It's called The Bay. Now, you might not pay $1.5 million for that. I might not pay $1.5 million for that. But that's what the insurance company says it's worth. And this student went up and very thoughtfully pulled out his wad of chewing gum and stuck it on the corner of that $1.5 million painting. Now, at first, we think, well, that's creepy and stupid and kind of a childish thing to do. But upon further examination, it turns out that that absolutely is a classic sin. And not just vandalism, it's a classic sin. Let me show you why. First of all, it was a deliberate act. It wasn't a mistake, wasn't a miscalculation. It's not that he was trying to do something else and slipped. He meant to do that. Besides that, it was intended, it had a meaning, it was intended to lower the value of the painting and elevate himself. I rather expect that all of his buddies standing around were snickering and kind of egging him on at that. And so it was intended for him to elevate himself and lower the value of that painting at the same time. Also, its effects were very far-reaching. Like all sin, its effects were very far-reaching. There were costs that were incurred to clean and restore the painting. That gum did stain the painting, and they had to fix that. That means that the painting was removed from the gallery, and some people who might have come looking for it didn't get to see that painting, so they're deprived of that. In addition to that, there was reduced access to the painting in the future. More people are not going to be able to get as close as he was. I guarantee you they have moved that painting to a more secure location, so that doesn't happen again. The world is less civil, and a lot of other students are going to be penalized because of that. They're not going to get close to that painting, not going to be able to look at it very well because of what this little character did. So it had some far-reaching consequences. Besides that, he corrupted himself when he did that. Now, here's the thing about sin, and just hang with me for a minute on this. Here's the thing about sin. When you sin, two things happen. One of two things happens. Either you generate within yourself a sense of guilt and shame that you have to somehow deal with, or you kill your conscience a little bit so that you don't have any guilt or shame and you become like a weasel. You know, a weasel is a killing machine. A weasel will get in the hen house and kill every chicken in the hen house. Can't possibly eat them all, but just for the love of killing, it will get in there and kill them all. Well, that's what happens to people who kill their sense of conscience. When they can't tell the difference from right and wrong anymore, they are just unthinking animals. They're just like a weasel in the hen house. Or you have to live with this sense of guilt and shame that goes on and on. And lest you think that that's not really true, this past week I saw on the internet a story about a guy in Norway who had shoplifted some trinkets out of a little souvenir store in Norway in 1970, 37 years ago. For 37 years, that has been eating at him, that he stole. It wasn't even worth very much, but it just kind of ate at him that he stole that stuff. So he sent a check for $480 for the cost of the trinkets plus interest for 37 years and sent it back to this town in Norway and asked the mayor to find out who the shopkeeper was. He didn't even know the name of the shop. And anyway, for 37 years, that man carried his guilt around. You know it happens, and I do too. You may be carrying a load of guilt around for things that you've done in the past. In addition to that, his sin was an attack on other people. It was an attack on other viewers. It was an attack on the museum staff and patrons. It was an attack on the artist. The thing about it is, the student was blind to all of that. He never thought about any of that stuff. It never occurred to him that there were ramifications beyond what he was doing. His problem was he neither feared nor hated his sin. He wasn't afraid of it, and he didn't hate it either. And that means that he is doomed to a life of misery and unhappiness and to an eternity of unimaginable suffering as he enters hell, a place of complete ungodliness. See, here's our problem. We don't hate and fear the sin in our own lives. We have been desensitized by our culture so that we don't hate and fear sin in our own lives. Let me ask you a question. You don't answer this, all right? Just think about this in your own mind. I don't want to hear any answers about it. Do you ever lie? You ever just withhold information? It's not like you told a lie. You just kind of held some information behind your back. Didn't mention that. It didn't come up. So we don't tell everything, see. Ever try to get a coworker fired or transferred because you didn't like that person? Ever cherish hatred and dream of vengeance against somebody who's done you some little injury? Ever gossip about anybody? Ever ridicule a family member? We all complain about the incivility of our world. Everything from drive-by shootings to casual dismissal by store clerks and government employees. There's something just peculiarly maddening about going into a government office and being treated like you're a piece of garbage and you have no business being there. There's just something peculiarly infuriating about that. But it does happen. It's happened to you. It's happened to me. It happens at different times. We have to put up with thoughtless profanity out here in the world. People don't ever think about what they're saying. It just spills right out of their mouths. We got vandalism and we've got theft that goes on. And then we just add to that whole cesspool by our own sins and we cheapen and degrade our world ourselves. We do that. Problem is we don't hate and fear the sin in our lives. In 1734... Jonathan Edwards preached a sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. This is a picture of Jonathan Edwards. Looks like the kind of guy that could do that, doesn't he? Looks like a guy who could preach that sermon. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Now, you have to see this in its context. 1734, Litchfield, Connecticut. The people of Litchfield had to have a preacher that Sunday. They didn't really want one. You know how that goes, right? They didn't really want one, but they needed a preacher that Sunday. So they invited a guy named Samuel Stoddard to come. Well, Samuel Stoddard was a very highly respected clergyman in Massachusetts, and he couldn't go. So he sent his grandson, Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards went down there, and he was the most non-dynamic speaker you can imagine. Stood up there like a talking head and read his sermon from a handwritten manuscript, just page after page. He didn't look up. He just read what he had on the page, page after page. And the people of Litchfield had heard about this religious fervor that was happening up in Massachusetts, and they're not going to get caught up in that. They're way too sophisticated and cool for that. So this wasn't going to happen. And so here comes Jonathan Edwards with his completely wooden delivery into a bunch of people who didn't want to hear it to begin with. And he stood up there and he preached Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, an absolutely watershed sermon. By the time he finished the sermon, an hour and a half later, women were sobbing in their pews. Men were holding on to the pew in front of them to keep themselves from falling into hell on the spot. And we think, how could they get so wound up by that? Oh, and by the way, that kind of ignited a whole new wave of religious feeling all through Connecticut, not just Litchfield. And a lot of people learned more about God and drew nearer to Him because of that. You know, how could that happen? Well, the way it happened is those people hated and feared their sin. The same sermon today, preached anywhere in the United States of America, and by the time the preacher was done, half the audience would be gone and the other half would be asleep. We're sleepers in the hands of an angry God now. We don't hate and fear our sin. See, there's a way things are supposed to be. God created the world, and at the end, His verdict was, it is very good. Now, we would call that righteous. Everything was righteous. Everything was working in perfect harmony. Sin chips away at that righteousness, and it vandalizes God's creation, and it inclines us to do it again. Now, God isn't offended by sin just to stay in practice. He didn't do that just to stay in practice. When He created the heavens and the earth and everything in it, He declared it very good. And He did it just the way He wanted it to be done. Everything was lined up exactly the way He wanted it. But then Adam and Eve came along and decided that God was wrong, and they knew better. And what they would do would be completely different from what He had in mind. And they taught their children to vandalize creation. And we have been sticking wads of chewing gum on God's artistry ever since. And even when we see what sin does to our lives and to our world, we don't hate and fear sin in our lives. To ignore the sin in our lives is the most delusional kind of thinking. We're absolutely in an unreal place and in an unreal world to take sin lightly. Because the truth of the matter is, our sin ruined this world. God didn't create a world with earthquakes, tuberculosis, cystic fibrosis, and many other things. He didn't create a world like that. Our sin impacted every part of God's creation and has ruined it and defaced it, and brought about this world that we're in. Our sin corrupted our souls. We have become violent, corrosive kinds of people. We're competitive. We're very self-focused. And we teach our children to do that. We tell our neighbors to do that. And that's what culture applauds and rewards. Sin brought death into the world. That's Romans chapter 5, verse 12. So in this way, sin came by one man, and death by sin. And so death came to all men because all have sinned. Romans chapter 5, verse 12. Sin condemned us to be adversaries of God, enemies. You know, in Isaiah chapter 59, people of Israel are having a very difficult time. And God says to them, among the many things God says, He says, it is not that the arm of the Lord is too short to save you, like He just can't quite reach. It's not that the arm of the Lord is too short to save, nor His ear too deaf to hear you. But your sin has separated you from your God, and He will not hear. Sin has condemned us to be adversaries of God. And of course, most terribly, our sin brought about the murder of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's what Peter said in Acts chapter 2 and verse 23. This man, you with the help of lawless men, did crucify and slay. I don't think God is going to take the murder of His Son lightly. For us to take sin lightly is the worst kind of delusional thinking. And still, we don't hate and fear sin in our lives. Now, Jesus came to redeem us from sin. So the question is, who is it that needs Jesus? Who needs Jesus? Jesus says sinners need Jesus. Let's go to Luke chapter 5. We're going to look at three passages very quickly tonight. Luke chapter 5. We're going to start in Luke chapter 5. We're going to look at three short passages and just think about who needs Jesus. Who is it that needs Jesus? First of all, sinners need Jesus. In Luke chapter 5, beginning in verse 27, says, "After this, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector by the name of Levi sitting at his tax booth." You all know that's Matthew we're talking about. Levi also has another name. His name is Matthew. That's the same one who wrote the Gospel of Matthew, started out his career as a tax collector. "After this, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector by the name of Levi sitting in his tax booth. 'Follow me,' Jesus said to him, and Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. Then Levi held a great banquet for Jesus at his house, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, who belonged to their sect, complained to his disciples, 'Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?' And Jesus answered them, 'It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I'm not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance.'" The sinners are those people who already kind of know their failure. Sin, biblically, sin is both missing the mark. You see, this guy's an expert rifleman, right? Sin is both missing the mark and it's stepping over the line. You've gone too far. You've missed what you're aiming at and you've gone too far. And some of us are all too aware of our own failures and our own shame. We disappoint ourselves often. Even when we know to do right, we often do what is wrong and we disappoint ourselves. Sinners are people who know their own failure. Sinners are people who want to be righteous. These Pharisees thought they were okay. Why do you eat with sinners? Why do you hang out with these kinds of people? If you're a righteous man, shouldn't you gather with your own kind and avoid contamination by those folks? Everybody wants to be an insider. We all want to be inside. When you're in high school, you want to be in the cool group. When you're on the job, you want to be in the know with all those people who are on the inside. We all want to be on the inside somewhere. The ultimate inside is to be with God in perfect righteousness, and that's the way God created us to be, perfectly righteous. Those who are sinners are those who want to be on the inside. They want to be righteous with God. And sinners are those people who can't undo what they've done. One of the greatest... sometimes when you're dealing with computers, you go in there and you put a new program on a computer and it messes everything up. I mean, this thing will not work right. Oh, it is a major frustration. You just want to take a hammer to the thing. And you also want to take a hammer to the guy that wrote the program, but that's a different story. But in the newer versions of Windows in the computer, they've got this wonderful little program called Restore. You can do a system restore. What you do is you go inside this menu here and you pick a date on the calendar when your computer was working real well and you click on it right there and you say, "I want my computer to be just like it was on that day." And you click it and you say, "Okay," and the computer goes, "Okay," and it wipes out everything you've done since And it takes you back in time to the perfect day when everything was wonderful and marvelous. Don't you wish you could do that with your life? Don't you wish you had a system restore, an undo button for your life? Or you go back the day before you ruined that lifelong friendship with your big smart mouth? Don't you wish you could just undo that whole day, make it like it never happened? Before you commit that one sin whose ramifications roll on down through your whole life, don't you wish you could just kind of go back and do an undo real quick? Can't do an undo. We can't do that. What we need is forgiveness. We need the Lord to step up and say, I'm going to make it like it never happened for you. As far as you and I are concerned, I make it like it never happened. It never happened. See, those are the people who need Jesus. People who can't undo their sin. Need somebody to make it right again. That's why Jesus calls us to Himself. The people who need Jesus are sinners. And the people who need Jesus are those who are lost. So flip over to Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19, verse 10. One of our favorite stories here. We could tell the whole story about Zacchaeus, the tax collector. You know, he's a wee little man hiding in there. He's not hiding. He's climbed the tree so he can see Jesus going by. And Jesus calls him down, and they go to the home of Zacchaeus, another tax collector, by the way. Jesus seems to get along well with the tax collectors. And verse 9, Luke chapter 19, verse 9. Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. Lost. What a vivid metaphor. To save what was lost. This is a picture of Daniel Boone. Somebody asked Daniel Boone late in life one time, they said, were you ever lost? And he said, no, I never was lost. No. There was one time for about 3 days when I was kind of bewildered. He was lost, folks. He didn't know where he was. And that's the whole thing about being lost. Lost people know they're not where they need to be. They don't know where they are. But wherever they are, it's not where they need to be. Let me ask you a question. Where are you spiritually? Where are you? Do you know where you are spiritually? Do you know what kind of relationship you have with God? Do you know what you're supposed to be? How you doing? People who are lost don't know where they are. That's really distressing, too, because that also means they don't know how to get home. Which direction do you start? Wouldn't you like to take a walk in a maze like that? There are several mazes. Well, that's a hedge maze, and you can see these people here walking along, and they can't see where they're going. Now, from our perspective, we could tell them, go forward and then turn to the right. Don't go left. It's not going to take you where you want to go. You be sure and go to the right. They can't tell because they're stuck inside the maze. That's the way our lives are. We can't see over the edges. We can't see what's ahead or around the bend. We wish we could. There are a whole lot of weather forecasters that wish they'd done a better job of looking ahead to see, you know, what's coming along. They didn't get that right. There's a place somewhere I belong, but I don't know how to get there from here. How am I going to find my... I don't even know where I'm at. How will I know how to get there? I can't even tell where I'm at right now. People who are lost don't know where they are. They don't know how to get home. They don't know what to do about it. They don't have the first idea where to start. We can't retrace our steps. Unfortunately, time is a one-way trip. You cannot regain time. You can't go backward. There's no restore point. So we can't go backward. And if we just flail around out here, inevitably that just makes it worse. We need a guide. We need somebody who's above the maze who can say, don't go left. That's not going to take you where you want to go. You need to go right. And then I'll tell you where to go at the next turn. We need somebody who is above it all. See, Jesus came to find us and take us home where we belong. Those who need Jesus are people who are lost. And those who need Jesus are people who want a full life. Skip over to John chapter 10 with me, if you would. This is another one of those comments that Jesus makes that are just so profound. In John chapter 10, he talks about
being the gate of the sheep. In John chapter 10 and verse 10, he says, "The thief, the enemy, the thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Life and have it to the full. Those who want a full life really want life. They'd just rather not die entirely. Woody Allen, probably not the best theological resource, but Woody Allen said, "I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." Now, a lot of people feel that way. "I just don't want to be there when it happens. I don't mind dying." But death is inescapable. We know that life is swift, and death is fearful to us because it's unknown. We don't know what's on the other side. We've never been there before. There are a lot of people who want life. They want just not to die at all. But not only that, they want to be significant somehow. They want their life to have mattered. One writer said, "It must be terrible for a man to come to the midpoint of his life and realize that his talent, his energy, all his potential that he had, his good grades that he made in school, it's all been aimed toward an advertising career where he made people deeply desire to have automatic card shufflers." Can you think of a more insignificant way to spend your life? Everybody wants to be someone important, to have some significance in life. Worse than death, honestly, is a useless life. Everybody wants to make a difference. And that, unfortunately, very often leads to sin. People lie about themselves to make themselves more impressive so that people will give them the significance that they think they deserve. They just tell the most amazing whoppers, absolute lies. People want a full life. They want to be significant. They want to be happy. You know, fundamentally, they just want to be happy in life. Happiness isn't an end in itself. It's a byproduct of a good life. You lead a good life and you will be happy. Satisfaction that comes from knowing that you've done all the good that you can do. Jesus offers us that full life. "I came that they may have life," he says, "and have it to the full. He who believes in me will live even though he dies, and he who lives and believes in me will never die," he says. "I am the resurrection and the life," he said, John 11:25. "I'm the resurrection and the life." See, these are the people who need Jesus, people who are sinners, people who are lost, whoever it is that wants a full life. Everybody needs Jesus because everybody has sinned. Of course, yeah, okay, look, there are people who think they've never sinned, or if they have sinned, it was always somebody else's fault. There's a word for those people. We call them self-righteous. And they're not all in the church. And they don't all claim to be followers of Jesus. There are an awful lot of self-righteous people in the world who believe they've never sinned, or if they have, then it's somebody else's fault and they're not going to be held accountable for it. You ever notice that all sin, by the way, is about self? It's always about me. Sin is always about self. Make me happy, you know, let me do better, let me push somebody else out of the way and get there first. It's always about self. Maybe that's why we don't hate and fear sin, because I did it myself. It's all mine. It doesn't matter. You know, it ruins my life, wounds other people, kills me in the end, but boy, I did it myself. It's all mine. Who needs Jesus? Everybody needs Jesus, because everybody has sinned. See, only in Jesus can we be righteous. Can we be safe at home? And can we live satisfying, full lives? We're going to sing an invitation song and give you an opportunity. If you're lost and you don't know how to get home, Jesus can help you. He'll help you get home. If you're a sinner and you know it, you have borne all this shame and guilt for a long time and you need to lay it down, Jesus will forgive that and make it like it never happened in your relationship with Him. If you just want a full and satisfying life and you realize that all the work that you've done, everything that you've accomplished so far, still just leaves you hollow. Is this all there is? Automatic card shufflers? Is that it? You can come to the Lord and give Him your life, and He will make something wonderfully valuable and powerful and important out of it in His kingdom. If you need to respond publicly to Jesus' invitation, we urge you to do it right now while we stand together and sing.